This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
Welcome to Rear Vision here on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, with me, Annabel Quince.
And I believe the mood of the nation is that we need to ask the Australian people for a mandate to take Commonwealth responsibility for full funding for public hospitals into the future.
When Kevin Rudd declared he'd take over public hospitals unless the states and territories agreed to end the blame game on health, he gave a deadline of mid-2009. The National Health and Hospital Commission report outlines three possible alternatives. One, where responsibility for health is shared with the states. Another, where the Commonwealth would run health services through local authorities. And another involving a national social health insurance scheme like those overseas. The National Health and Hospital Reform Commission was set up by the Rudd government last year. It was charged with addressing the current crisis in public hospitals and stopping the blame game between the states and the Commonwealth over health. Under the Australian Constitution, responsibility for the public health systems lies with the states. But from 1942 onwards, the Commonwealth increasingly funded the systems, hence the current blame game. Last month, the Commission released its interim report outlining three alternatives for the health service in Australia. Two where greater responsibility would shift to the Commonwealth, and a third where responsibility would remain with the states. While the Commission works out which alternative it will recommend, we thought we could add to the debate by looking at the origins of the Australian public hospital systems. Like so many institutions in Australia, the various public hospital systems have their origins in six separate and quite different colonies. Australia's first public hospital was built in Sydney around 1816. But as Judith Godden, Honorary Associate in the Department of History at the University of Sydney, explains, the medical care was somewhat rough and ready.
And that's the famous Rum Hospital. The matrons at the time were housekeepers, hospital housekeepers. Any kind of nursing that was done was often done by convalescent patients who were well enough to get off their beds and hold a scrubbing brush to clean the wards. And really, they just picked up any knowledge that they could. And you also get the ex-convicts running the hospital. One of the long-standing matrons was Bathsheba Ghost, wonderful name. She was an ex-convict. She was convicted for receiving stolen goods of jewellery. And she was absolutely dedicated to Sydney Hospital and stayed there until she died. I mean, it was a rough and tumble place, but there's no doubt that she gave it her all.
So who were the kinds of people that went to Sydney Hospital in the early days? Were they the poorer people or the middle class people or richer people?
Richer people, anyone who could afford it, wouldn't dream of going to a hospital. That'd be like us going to another city and decided we'll doss down at a homeless refuge. It was just unthinkable. So hospitals were for the poor, people that didn't have anyone else to look after them at home and just had no other alternative, couldn't afford to hire the nurses or the doctors to come into their own home. So it's very much a charitable institution, and that's a key to understanding the development of hospitals.
As the populations of other colonies grew, they also acquired hospitals. But as Jim Gillespie, Deputy Director of the Menzies Centre for Health Policy, explains, each colony developed its own unique hospital system.
Well, it depended a lot on the wealth of the colony, because that in turn influenced the role of government. And so you had, in the 19th and early 20th centuries, at one extreme, Victoria, which was the wealthiest state with the largest philanthropic tradition, had what were called voluntary hospitals set up by subscription, by philanthropists, aimed at the sick poor. At the other extreme, colonies like Western Australia and Queensland, government played a much bigger role because of distance and lack of that civil society to establish a private sector. And so the hospitals there all were much more under control and dependent on government funding. And in those states, there were intense struggles between the medical profession and the state government over control. In Victoria, because of that independence from government, the medical profession had a much greater dominance over the way things worked, particularly as the 20th century developed. In states like Queensland, there were quite, and Tasmania, with two that had quite violent conflicts between state governments and the medical profession. In both those cases, the state government effectively won eventually and brought medical profession largely under its control.
From the 1840s onwards, medical care in public hospitals improved. First with the introduction of germ theory and then trained nurses.
From about the 1840s, you got the concept of clean medicine, beginning of the thought that perhaps pus was a bad sign. Before it was seen, oh, this was good, this was the body getting rid of excess problems in the body. But now they thought that rather than getting rid of the bad things in the body, perhaps you can nourish and sustain the body. And then from the middle of the 19th century, you got the introduction of anesthetics for surgery, then gradually you get the introduction of the germ theory, and gradually from the 1890s, aseptic technique, where you're excluding germs from the wounds. So by the turn of the 20th century, really to maintain these standards of cleanliness, have these kind of operations, it was no longer feasible to clear away your kitchen table and have the surgeon operate on you there. You really needed to go into hospital. And in Australia, it really began with Lucy Osborne, and she was the one who brought out the concept of trained nurses.
And so what time was this? What time are we talking about?
Lucy Osborne came here in 1868, and she stayed to 1884 at Sydney Hospital, by which time she'd firmly established the concept of the Nightingale system, where nurses needed to be treated of reasonable decency and to get training, and it gradually spread throughout Australia from there.
On the 31st of December in the year 1900, Her Majesty Queen Victoria numbered among her possessions overseas the colonies of New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Tasmania, Queensland and Western Australia. On the 1st of January 1901, Her Majesty was graciously pleased to proclaim the colonies constituted into the Federal Commonwealth of Australia.
The only power the Constitution gave the Commonwealth was a quarantine power. And as far as hospitals went, when it took over the Northern Territory, it ran hospitals there. And from the late 1920s, when the capital moved to Canberra, there was a hospital in Canberra. But that was the limit of Commonwealth involvement. The hospitals were the responsibility of the states, completely in constitutional and in financial terms.
Middle-class people, really, by the 20th century, they were firmly seeing hospital care as necessary. It was a medical institution, it offered better care than you could get in home, and it was your right to go there. And then later there was a development of private wards and intermediate wards in the hospital, so that you weren't actually mixing in the public ward. You were expecting a better standard of care, but you're paying for that care.
Running a hospital becomes much more expensive because of the much more sophisticated technologies at work, and most people for complex procedures now wanted to come into public hospitals, so the cost of the public hospitals went up considerably, and there just wasn't the pool of private charitable funding, even in states like Victoria, to sustain this sort of development. And so governments gradually started moving in and taking some control. And at the same time, there was a very strong middle-class constituency that started agitating for better and broader access to public hospitals. And the public hospitals saw this middle-class clientele as a new source of funding. And so Australia started looking, traditionally it had looked at Britain. In the 1920s it started looking at the United States. And there are several big delegations to the US and of US surgeons here to advise on how to develop a large and sophisticated private sector within the public sector.
So in essence, they started charging middle-class people for coming into hospital.
Yeah, they brought in what were called intermediate wards, where people had to pay for their beds. And the means testing that had traditionally kept the middle classes out now became a system of deciding who was to pay and who wasn't. And a whole profession called the hospital almoner, which current social workers, actual hospital social workers, trace themselves back to this profession that was originally about working out the means of someone and whether they should pay and how much they should pay.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, with me, Annabel Quince. Today we're taking a look at the history of our public hospital systems. The issue of free access to public wards in public hospitals became a critical issue for successive federal governments. In 1942, the Commonwealth government began collecting income tax. In 1945, the then Labor government enacted the Hospital Benefits Act, whereby the Commonwealth paid the states a fixed amount per day for patients in public hospitals, provided the states abolish the means test.
There was actually a national committee looking into the Commonwealth taking over hospitals. This was set up under this National Health and Medical Research Council, and it had some doctors and nurses looking at it. When Labor came in, they appointed a Treasury man to it, and he headed off in his own direction. The others were looking at counting beds and looking at the feasibility of the Commonwealth taking some direct control. The Treasury man was much more interested in how much does it cost per bed, and what came out of his work was a hospital benefits scheme. The Commonwealth did not want to affect the way the hospitals operated. They didn't want to take over control. They wanted to leave them in private or in state hands, church hands. They certainly didn't want to fight with the Catholic Church about taking things over, nor with the medical profession. So what they did was a sort of lowest common denominator. They said, this is roughly how much it costs per bed day in your average public hospital. What we will do is give a benefit per day, per bed day, for patients admitted, and in return, the states will have to remove all means testing for public hospitals. So we will take over an indirect subsidy, and we have no interest in saying what the hospitals can do other than that they cannot charge a means test. And that's really the Commonwealth's approach to hospitals today. Really is still this subsidy through the states indirectly. It's done on a different basis, but without any real control. And in return, about two conditions. One is a reporting one, just send us some data. And the second one is you must not means test.
I am very happy to be here today to open Australia's most modern hospital. Throughout the British Commonwealth, the prevention of disease and the establishment of medical services has been a feature of our way of life. Wonderful work has been done in the past by voluntary organisations. More recently, the state has shouldered a larger share of this burden and is using its greater financial resources to supplement the work of the older organisations. I now have much pleasure in declaring open the Queen Elizabeth Hospital.
During the 1950s and 60s, despite the fact that the Menzies government had reintroduced a means test, the public hospital systems continued to expand. As they grew, they relied heavily on the services of honorary doctors. Kerry Galston is Emeritus Professor of Medicine at the University of Sydney and has worked in the public hospital system for over 30 years.
It was Robin Hood medicine. There were very few staff specialists, that is, salaried full-time specialists. And all the, what we now call visiting medical officers, were honorary. So they worked for nothing in the public hospital system. And they had a major role in the running of hospitals. They had quite a lot of power in the hospitals, more actually than the nurses. We taught students in those days for no recompense, and we looked after public patients for nothing. The training was good, and the standard of care was good, but it was at a much slower pace than it is now.
The honorary system, when it worked well, was brilliant. What it meant was that doctors came into the hospitals, sometimes perhaps just 6 or 7 hours a week, and donated their medical skills for free to the hospital. In exchange, they had patients referred to them by other doctors, essentially could practice in the hospital and on the hospital patients, and they built up their careers. Many of them were utterly devoted to the hospitals of which they were honoraries too. So at its best, it worked brilliantly. The problem came when, again, medicine is changing all the time. It's getting more and more complex. You're doing more and more complex operations. Now, for example, you might have operations going for 8 hours, yet you've got an honorary you might want to operate. Well, he's only coming in the hospital. I'm saying he because it usually is a he. Only coming into the hospital for 6 or 8 hours a week anyway. So the whole thing is becoming trickier and trickier. And then there's the example of the Johns Hopkins Hospital Medical School in America. And they had salaried doctors. And yet here was in the land of the free enterprise, were actually running a brilliant hospital with salaried doctors. So that was another model that was working against the honorary system.
In 1973, the Whitlam government tried to tackle the issue of access to public hospitals by again abolishing the means test.
In the current dispute between the states and the federal government over free public ward treatment in hospitals, the Prime Minister, Mr. Whitlam, last night hinted that the federal government may establish its own free hospitals.
The Australian government and Parliament have the duty and the right to provide medical services. And if we do not get cooperation from the states and from the Liberals in the Senate, maybe the Commonwealth will then establish hospitals itself.
He had a terrible conflict with both the Parliament, because he didn't control the Senate, and the medical profession. And so it wasn't until the last gasp of Whitlam government, it's often forgotten, it's not till July 1975 that Medibank came in. The Whitlam government fell in early November 1975, so he only ran it for a few months. What he would have done in the future, we don't know. His inclination was that Canberra could do things better than the states.
From October 1st, everyone will have to be covered by one of Australia's health insurance schemes. 1. Standard Medibank. 2. Standard Medibank plus extra hospital insurance. Or 3. Complete private medical and hospital insurance with Medibank Private or any other private fund.
Medibank, which was really a funding system, again, it was in that welfare model. And its designers, John Deeble and Dick Scotton, have both described it as a system that was about access, doing as little as possible to change the way the system operated.
First thing is that the honorary specialists started getting paid, usually on a sessional payment, and this was controlled by the hospital, of course, because they were being paid for their services. There were increasing number of appointments of full-time salaried specialists within the hospital. And gradually, super specialisation occurred. So that, for example, in New South Wales, there was one salaried gastroenterologist at Prince Alfred. Now there'd be 50 throughout New South Wales. So gradually, the numbers of super specialists increased. The number of general physicians and general surgeons decreased.
The changes introduced first by Medibank and later by Medicare coincided with a dramatic increase in the cost of hospital care and a decrease in the amount of money coming to the states from the Commonwealth. Neither side of federal politics during the 70s and 80s was able or willing to increase spending on health, which meant that the states could no longer expand their public hospital systems.
Well, the big bind they were in was they had less money to go around and had to work out where to make the cuts to balance their budgets. The politics of that, it's a traditional federal-state thing, shift the political costs onto the states, and a lot of the state governments got problems of closing beds, closing hospitals. Again, the biggest closures happened in New South Wales, where several of the old inner-city hospitals like Crown Street Hospital for Women, which had been going since the 19th century, was closed down and its resources shifted out west. A longer-term process was that to set up a new children's hospital out at Westmead, the children's hospital in Camperdown was closed down. Queen Victoria Hospital, rather, right in the centre of Melbourne, was closed down and its resources shifted out to Clayton, out in the southeastern suburbs.
Along with the shift in resources, there was also a centralisation of authority from hospital boards and clinical staff to regional or area health services.
There are probably good things in the sense that that level of central planning was inevitable because of the need for cutting. The problem with the current system is it often leads to centralisation of strategic directions, but a lot of confusion about who is responsible for the particular things that go on within the system, and particularly the stripping away of a lot of the responsibility of clinical staff. There's a very large level of alienation you find there, and a lot of that is a sense that decisions that they should be making that can be better done locally, or even input they should be making, has been moved to area health services. There are different names in different states, or to the central health department, or even the minister's office.
The community who live round a small hospital do not feel the same ownership of that hospital as they used to 20, 25 years ago. Some of them still raise money for their local hospital, particularly in country towns, but they don't feel engaged. They don't feel that they have a sense of ownership of the hospital, and they don't feel trusted or communicated with by the people who are running the system. So there has been a tremendous disconnect between the people working in the hospital, but also the management of the hospital, the management of the system, and the community at large, and particularly local communities. You know, and when I started many years ago, the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, Royal North Shore Hospital, had boards, and the chairman of the board would have been the CEO of Westpac or ANZ or something, and they were not frightened to go to the minister and say, hey, I don't like what you're doing to the hospital. They'd stand up for their hospital. Similarly, in small little hospitals, the same thing occurred. And that's gradually been eroded, and it has to be changed. It has to be brought back. The community involvement and engagement in our health system has to be brought back.
At the same time that community involvement in the public hospital system was declining, the private hospital system was expanding.
We've always had private hospitals. What's developed over the last decade or so is a much larger for-profit health system, partly but not wholly funded by private health insurance. It actually only pays a part of the cost of the private hospitals. A large part of the medical expenses are paid by Medicare, and a large part are paid out of people's pockets. And one striking thing about Australian health statistics is that we pay more out of our own pockets for health services, particularly hospital services, than any other developed OECD country. We often think of the United States as the land of private health. They pay a tiny fraction of what we pay out of pocket. Our private health insurance only pays about 7% of the costs of our health system. And that's an area that has been growing, and it's been one that's caused governments great grief.
Public hospitals in crisis have been said so many times and for so long that the urgency and substance of the message seems to have all but lost its impact. but a group of those at the coalface of public hospitals believes the crisis is intensifying and that the worst is yet to come. The doctors warn that many hospitals are already dangerous places, especially in essential areas such as emergency or intensive care.
It's real throughout Australia. It's multifactorial. We've got increasing costs of healthcare. We've got things that we do for patients which are very, very expensive, whether they're operations on the heart, whether they're cancer drugs, whether they're renal dialysis, whether they're transplants. They're very, very expensive. And the number of old people in the hospitals is going up who require special care. The state and the federal government and the bureaucrats try to control costs, but the doctors who look after the patients feel the patients come first and they want what is best for their individual patient. So there is that's one cause of a tension between clinicians and managers. And we have a health workforce shortage in medicine, nursing and in allied health. We are short of people, as is every other country in the world, and we haven't really tackled that.
Vanessa Anderson died at Royal North Shore Hospital in November 2005, 2 days after she'd been hit in the head by a golf ball. The Deputy State Coroner, Carl Milovanovic, has found the 16-year-old died of respiratory arrest. He's also said her death was avoidable, and he'd never before seen a case in which almost every conceivable error had been committed.
I think the care overall is very, very good. The statistics bear that out. Mistakes have always been made and will continue to be made, and we try to prevent mistakes. But the beat-up of the media and the engagement and micromanagement of politicians has been a disaster, and that has eroded further the morale of people working in the system.
It's very easy to be nostalgic about the past. The battle axe sister coming down in a starch white uniform and vial and sorting everything out, and you think, wouldn't that be wonderful? But yes, it is nostalgia. There have been major problems in the past. Today, these problems are more open. It's not to say there's not major problems in our hospitals today, and it's something that needs to be sorted out and sorted out very quickly. But this is equally applied in the past.
There's a sense of crisis around the hospitals, but it's very difficult to put your finger down on exactly one element that's at the core. Funding would clearly help emergency departments handle their loads, particularly at peak moments. But one thing that we've known since the 1960s is that if you expand hospitals, the demand for them expands. Supply creates demand in this area. And so just putting in more money isn't going to solve the problem. The crisis is it's in all sorts of strange areas. In some areas, hospitals don't seem able to process ordinary bills of local tradespeople, continually having to close down wards because they can't serve people food because the local greengrocer won't provide it anymore. A lot of that seems to be the effect of excessive centralisation. But there are also some deeper structural problems that are much harder for governments to tackle. One is that our hospital system is really designed in the 1950s through to the 70s to deal with these problems of access that were left over from the 40s and 50s. They're really an idea that the problems we face are of people getting ill and either being fixed up by their GP quickly or going into hospital for a short period of treatment for an acute illness and either dying or being discharged, cured. What we've had over the last few decades with an ageing society and the antibiotic revolution is that acute burden of disease has been declining. And what we've got now is a much more difficult set of health problems around chronic illnesses. The crisis, it's complicated, it's got lots of different elements, but the big structural one that no government report is going to have a magic wand to solve is around issues like this.
Jim Gillespie, ending our look at Australia's public hospitals. Our other guests were Dr. Kerry Goulston and Judith Godden. Today's sound engineer is Stephen Tilley, and this is Rear Vision here on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. I'm Annabelle Quince. Thanks as always for joining me.
Poetica has a new podcast series of Australian poetry, a pod of poets, 11 40-minute podcasts.
Love, the horizon is changing, and the surface we stand on sinks slightly as the warm air rises.
The poetry is all Australian and read by the authors.
Imagine being somebody. Yikes! How appalling. Like a toad, puffing up one's throat all day for a lot of other warts.
As well as audio, there are transcripts of poems and interviews, photographs of the poets, publication information, and interesting links.
Fly, tiny thought. Little page, go hide in the spiracles of shells until somebody finds you.
Hear this vibrant series of poems available now for downloading.
I feel all right. Even here, suspended in a humid room, with another summer to get through.
A pod of poets. Find all the details at the ABC Radio National website.